listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times to Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor. Really pleased to have with me Kevin Duffy. It's been a while since Kevin's been on the show, so let me just tell you a little bit about him. He is the principal of Baring Asset Management, which he co-founded in 2002, and the firm manages the Baring Core Fund. That's a contrarian macro-themed hedge fund with a flexible mandate. He has had a great deal of success in the past with his unique approach to the markets, a very free market, Austrian school approach that he has, a belief system that he employs and uses in the market and has done so very profitably in the past. So thank you for joining me again, Kevin. It's really good to have you with me.
Yeah, hi, Jay. Thanks for having me back on.
Yeah, it's absolutely a pleasure to have you, and I'm not sure why it's been so long, but I should tell our listeners that you also publish a newsletter called The Coffee Can Portfolio. And so before we get started, where can people go to sign up for that? Because it's a very reasonably priced letter, you were telling me. What's the website where they can go to sign up for your letter?
The website is thecoffeecanportfolio.com.
Okay, easy enough. The name of the letter, thecoffeecanportfolio.com. I've titled this show The Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds, but inherent into the idea of a delusional crowd gone mad is the view that just as free speech is no longer being allowed in America, at least to the extent it once was, Americans have also been denied free speech in terms of how they speak with their decisions in the marketplace. By manipulating markets, the Fed and our government has distorted price discovery in a host of markets, but most importantly of all, in my view, is a distortion of the capital markets. As David Stockman has opined on this show, and it seems totally logical to me, is that we can't really have capitalism if the voice of savers is not permitted to be heard regarding the price of capital. So, Kevin, I'm assuming that you probably more or less agree with that statement, but do you have any thoughts about that notion that individuals are denied free speech in terms of their market selection?
Sure. I'll take a crack at it. I think that information is decentralized. I think this is the insight of Friedrich Hayek. Mm-hmm. And that, this applies to across all realms, not just the financial markets. It applies to society. And, information is also not only decentralized, but it's discovered, and it's discovered at the edges, and you need people to push the edges. So the dissenters in society are very important. Thomas Jefferson had a quote, "Dissension is the greatest form of patriotism." It applies to science, that it's always the nonconformists, it's always the people at the edges that are very important. And I think you could also apply this to the lockdowns. One of the things that the lockdowns did was it closed information. Those experiments that would have taken place at the edges never got off the ground. And then, we come to the financial markets. It's very important that markets are free, that they are allowed to transmit information. They do it through the price system, and it's a very elegant system that's all at the decentralized level. The problem takes place when you start to impose order, this natural order at the decentralized level, but when you start to impose order from the top down, that's when you start to round those edges that are important, the fringes. You start to eliminate those, and then you it's this hubris of the central planner that he knows more than the market does.
Mm-hmm. It's sort of a protective device for the people that currently hold power, I would guess. Kevin, as you were just talking, we just had Dr. Quentin Henning on the last segment. And Dr. Henning, in among his geologist peers, is one of those people that are on the edges. He's on the edge. His concept of how the Witwaters Rand deposit was laid down has led him to Western Australia, where he's on the verge of discovering perhaps one of the greatest gold discoveries in a long time, in many decades. Time will tell, but it sure looks that way. So I hear what you're saying, and if we're not allowed to speak, then we're sort of shut down the creative side of society. We're not allowing new ideas to emerge, and then what happens to a society, and then more direct to our point, what happens to the financial markets?
Well, it leads to all kinds of distortions. And I think, it starts with probably the 800-pound gorilla in the room, the central bankers. And the problem is, it's price discovery is very important. And Jeff Deist with the Mises Institute just wrote an article, and he talked about all the different characters that are involved. You have entrepreneurs, you have traders, you have investors, you have speculators, you have day traders, mm-hmm. short sellers, naked short sellers, gamblers. Everybody is jumping in and trying to discover the right prices. And those that do the job the best profit, and those that don't go out of business. But it's always tending towards finding the right price. And the problem is when you bring in the 800-pound gorilla, they don't care about the price. They have a different agenda. They have a political agenda. And so the price discovery is all about a dedication to reality. What you see from the top down with the central bankers is a detachment from reality. So what you start to do is create distortions in the market, and it creates a perverse set of incentives, and then you see the repercussions of that. You see it manifest itself in terms of, let's say, the passive bubble that we have, where you have a lot of price insensitive buyers. All they're doing is buying the S&P 500. They don't care what the makeup of it is. They don't care what the price of the stocks are in it. And then it gets progressively worse. And so I think the latest example of that was what we saw with the GameStop frenzy and these sort of garbage stocks that just went crazy a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, there's some that argue that that was a very good thing, in the sense that it allowed the little investor, the retail investor, the people, mostly younger people that signed on to Robinhood and opened accounts through Robinhood, it allowed them to give the rich and the powerful their comeuppance. As one who knows how to evaluate companies with value, you look at their balance sheets, at their income statements, and understand, cash flows and that sort of thing. And certainly that's what some of those hedge fund guys were doing, those guys that were shorting GameStop. So what is your analysis of that whole situation? First of all, I don't know if you've looked at GameStop. I have not. But, I mean, was there a reason to short GameStop? I guess that's my first question.
Yeah, that's a good question. And actually, I did look at GameStop. I follow the retail sector quite closely, and we own a number of those stocks. But I actually passed on GameStop because it looked like a melting ice cube, and those can be decent investments, but it just looked like there were much better opportunities elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of passed on it. I forgot about it. The stock was very cheap, but I just thought there were better opportunities. Anyway, then I see the stock starts to go crazy. I figured the business was worth on a good day, maybe $2 billion, maybe. Mm-hmm. And it went to a valuation of $25 billion. Mm-hmm. I mean, the stock was just absolutely through the moon. And there were some positive things going on. The founder of Chewy, he took a large position. So there were some catalysts, but mm-hmm. you know, obviously there was a lot more going on than just the fundamentals of the business.
Mm-hmm. And so the idea was that that these little guys could come in and give these guys their just desserts. I mean,
yeah, right.
Let me ask you though. There is, and I've been involved with a lot of smaller companies. It seemed to me that sometimes short sellers would jump on these companies almost hoping that they could drive them out of business. And I heard reports there was something like 140% of the float was short, or I don't know if the float or the total number of shares outstanding. Is it possible that sometimes the short sellers really overdo it, and they really do deserve some just desserts?
No, I think that's reasonable, and it's there's a lot of game theory involved here. Mm-hmm. You know, you can be right, but if you're not able to stay at the poker table, you can be right. taken out of the game. And I think mm-hmm. they were probably right fundamentally. They may have been right fundamentally. We'll see, mm-hmm. but they were vulnerable, and this is a way of testing that vulnerability. So in a sense, I guess you could say that. That there was a function, there was a market function, almost a stress test of the system. But I think we have to be a little cautious here, because this happened at the end of a massive bull market or a massive mania, whatever you want to call it. And so there is the short selling community has really been taken apart. I mean, there is not a whole lot left to it. And so when you get these big moves, you have those that are basically betting against it that are feeling all the stress, and they're being taken out of the game. So this is a way of basically flushing out what I think is probably relatively smart money from, I hate to use the term dumb money, but unsophisticated mm-hmm. money. And that's kind of what you see at major turning points. Jay, you could also look at this at the bottom. You know, mm-hmm. let's take, for example, 1998 and long-term capital management. Uh-huh. You know, the bets that they were making were probably, if you look back, you probably say those were proper bets. The mm-hmm. problem is they employed too much leverage. They were vulnerable, and all it took was a downturn, and all of the relationships that they assumed worked, they broke for a time. And they were taken out right at the bottom. So, you know, you get these major inflection points, and one of the things is you get something crazy like this happening. So I also think that, you know, a lot of people are siding with the young upstarts and, right. and all the rest of it. I look at it as they're just taking this gambling mentality. They've just taken it to a new level, and, you know, this democratization of finance, really, it's just it's the typical classic end of cycle behavior, where the retail investor is getting an invitation at the end of the party, and they're the ones that are left holding the bag. So even though they won one round at the poker table by this incredible bluff, mm-hmm. what happened was those poker players like Melvin Capital that were wiped out, they left the table, but those chairs were replaced by somebody else, and they were much bigger players, much deeper pocketed, and the stock went down about 80 or 90% from that point.
Right. No, it sure did. I mean, it's the mass delusions or the popular delusions and the madness of crowds, it seems, that what has been transpiring. Not just on that side from the little guys, but I would say the market as a whole. And you and I remember very well 2000, the dot-com bubble, It just seemed to go up and up and up, and there was no stopping it, and there were always new reasons why this time it's different. You're hearing the same thing now, Kevin, and how much longer can this thing go?
It really does seem very similar to 2000. There's so many ways of looking at this. There are similarities, and of course there are always differences, right? History doesn't always repeat. It rhymes. This idea of the day trader and the retail investor, of course, that is absolutely like 2000. The idea of stocks, running up stocks that are losing money. If you look at the hottest areas this year, the three hottest themes, one is the most shorted stocks, which we just talked about. The second is the non-profitable tech stocks, and then the SPACs, the special purpose acquisition companies. You have what do they say, Jay, that the pigs fly at the top? You know, that's the kind, you get this real garbage market at the top. You also, part and parcel with that is you get a hot IPO market. You know, we haven't seen that really since 2000. And there's a statistic that I track every week, which is the number of IPOs. It's reported in Barron's. And at the peak in 2000, that averaged about 13 a week. We're over 20 a week right now.
Wow. Oh. Yeah, well, money is flying around. It's free, right? So
it's free. And, you know, you asked about how long this can go on. It's what happens is, think of it as compulsive gambling, or think of it as the financial markets, what we talked about earlier, when you don't have the top down, the central bankers turning all the traffic lights green. It's orderly and it provides its function. But if left long enough, if distorted long enough, it basically turns into a casino. And the problem is when you start to invite novices to the casino, you get this sort of compulsive gambling effect. And so what happens is compulsive gambling is a progressive disease. And so the gambler is not content to just he's going to keep on amping up his risk level. And this is what we saw in 2000, and this is what we've been seeing this time. So for example, when the GameStop and the other stocks that were driven up by the Reddit and the Wall Street Bets crowd, when they were going crazy, they were de-risking in stocks like Apple and Amazon and Tesla. Those stocks actually went down that week. Now they've recovered because it can't get any crazier. This is something that's really important. If you go back to 2000, you saw this escalation in the craziness. So they would, at the very end, they would speculate in the dot-coms. You saw it also in 2006 and 2007 with the subprime bubble. You know, this was the worst of the worst mortgages that were being taken on and the money being lent. This happened in late 2006, and then that bubble burst in early 2007. So I think what we probably ought to – that's something that we should look for. Definitely that's a sign when you see this progressive nature and you see this parabolic frenzy going on. And then what we should look for – and also you see it with margin debt. Margin debt has been spiking. It's at record levels, almost $800 billion. And so what we should look for, I think, the next phase of this is – that the most marginal area will crack. Now, we certainly got that with the GameStop type of stocks, but you should see a crack in the most marginal areas, and also look for people to dismiss those warning cracks as isolated and contained. This is exactly what happened in 2000, and it's exactly what happened in 2007.
Mm-hmm. Sure. I remember our Federal Reserve chairman telling us it's isolated, these problems with the real estate market, for sure. Right. But again, I'm thinking, this is the masses of kids that were piling into this to buy GameStop. they weren't looking at the intrinsic value or lack thereof of this company. They were just simply jumping in. It's like a herd mentality, isn't it? It's like it's just like a massive assault. It's mindless, I think.
Yeah, it's crab behavior at its worst, and I think that's another sign. It's another element that you see at the end of a mania. I mean, a mania is a madness, and it's a collective delusion. It's the madness of crowds, you know.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
That's what it is.
Mm-hmm. Well, it reminds me a little bit of some of the stuff that was happening in the summer in the streets as well, but I don't know if there's any parallel to that or not, but it's a lot of craziness going on in a lot of areas of our lives, that's for sure. Well, I'd like to get to sort of the more practical side of what you do in your search to help your subscribers. You talked to me about something called an acronym called MOAT. Can you tell us what MOAT is and how you apply that in your letter?
Sure. MOAT is, I came up with this acronym. MOAT stands for margin of safety. So looking for businesses with a sustainable competitive advantage with a moat, so to speak, but also a valuation that affords you a margin of safety and a balance sheet that affords you that margin of safety. The O is for owner operators. So we're really looking for companies with skin in the game. The A is for away from the crowd. We try to avoid the crowd at all costs. And then T is for trends. Try to make sure we have as many trends, whether they be positive trends or negative trends, on our side. And that really is all about the stock selection.
And then you so you apply this to your stock picking, and I guess in your newsletter, do you actually get into specific recommendations?
Yes. What I've done is I track a model portfolio. I did that since day one. And so right now there are 27 equity participations. And what I do is I break down the portfolio into compartments. One is the coffee can. These are, and thus the name, the idea that you can find a very good business and that you want to basically put it in the coffee can and forget about it. Of course, mm-hmm. We can't totally forget about it. We still have to monitor the situation. The mm-hmm. The second category is opportunistic, and then speculations. The speculations tend to be very small. And then we have a section for reserves. I think it's very important to hold some reserves because I think every decade or so you get a great buying opportunity, but you're not going to be able to take advantage of it unless you have reserves. This is certainly a time for safety and a time where we want to have those reserves. And we don't just hold cash, Jay. We'll also hold precious metals. We see that as a surrogate for reserves. And then finally, we have a section for portfolio insurance.
Okay, and that might have to do with gold and silver and that sort of thing. Gold, anyway.
I count that as it's a good point. Gold is definitely a more defensive area. Mm-hmm. But I include that into the opportunistic and the coffee can section.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, it sounds like a lot of pretty practical stuff that you provide in your letter, and you always have a certain theme each. I guess you publish every other month, is it, Kevin?
Every 2 months, correct.
Every 2 months, okay. And your next letter will come out when?
I'm hoping to come out in a couple of weeks.
In a couple of weeks. Well, I'm going to start paying a lot of attention to what you're doing. I think you're on the right track in many ways, and I know that you and I have similar philosophies about free market economics. We're both Austrian school thinkers and believe that people should be free and their voices should be heard, both in every realm of our society. At least that's, I think, what our founding fathers believed. And free market economics has worked very, very well when it's allowed to exist, unfortunately. To a great extent, it's not. It's being stifled these days. But we will keep keep doing the best we can. And I thank you very much, Kevin, for spending the time with us today. And again, it's the coffee can. It's the coffeecanportfolio.com is where people should go, right, to sign
that's,
up for
that's
your letter.
Correct. Yes.
Excellent. All right. Well, that is all the time we have. Thank you so much for being with us, Kevin. And that's it for this week, folks. Next week, Michael Oliver will be with me, Michael Timmons of Fury Gold Mines. And I'm not sure who's going to be my main guest. There's still a couple of possibilities. So until then, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
Novo Resources Corp. trades on the OTCQX under the symbol NSRPF and on the TSX Venture Exchange under the symbol NVO. Its flagship assets are located in the Pilbara region of Western Australia. Novo has recently partnered with Sumitomo Corporation of Japan to evaluate, advance, and develop the company's Australian gold projects. With over $40 million in cash and $60 million committed from Sumitomo, Novo is well on its way to establishing itself as one of the top junior explorers and developers in Australia.